For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Why don't I pray for us before we get rolling here? Well, God, thanks for this couple of days here where we just get some extended time to reflect on you and our ministries and a variety of different topics that relate to those. Thank you that you've entrusted us with this super important task that we're going to talk about here this morning of passing on the gospel, Lord, passing on really the knowledge of you and the love of you to this next generation. And I know a lot of us here have a burden for this age group, and some of us are in this age group and want to reach our friends. And so I pray that your spirit would be calling our attention to certain things this morning that would be speaking through the things that we're going to say, as well as the things that people in the audience have to say. And I pray you would show up here this morning and help us to do this more effectively and more spiritually, God. Amen. All right, well, my name's Scott, and this is Conrad. We're going to be presenting on this subject here this morning. Just a little bit about us, briefly, before we get started here. This is a subject we both feel very passionate about, and we both devoted our lives to, I guess you might say. I've been part of Xenos's college group for about 12 years now. I came here as a freshman to Ohio State in 1996 and got involved with the campus group. This is after I became a Christian in high school in 1995, my senior year. I grew up around the church, but never really got it until then. So got involved. I've been involved here ever since. I've been on staff for about 5 years now. 5 years? Let's see. About 4 years. And I've been married for 6 years, and I've got a daughter who's almost two, and I've got a son who's due like next week. So Conrad has also been here for almost the same amount of time, came to Christ early in college, and he's been on staff for the past 3 years. He's also been married for about a year. We spend our pretty much all of our time with college and or high school students. What we want to talk to you about here this morning is it's the initial part is not very good news. Okay. The reality of the situation is that we're not doing a very good job of reaching young people in the church today. I've got a few statistics here. Josh McDowell from The Last Christian Generation has this to say. He says, in past years, between 55% and 66% of church young people have said that the church will play a part in their lives when they leave home. Now only 33% of church youth say that. So we're down to a third that are even thinking that the church is going to play a role in their life once they move out. Many have estimated that between 69% and 94% of their young people are leaving the traditional church after high school, and very few are returning. So that's at least two-thirds. In some cases, that's almost 19 out of 20 young people. So 1 in 20 are going to stick around is what is the estimates that are coming in on this. Pretty extreme. He goes on to say, even the ones that are sticking around, this chart is a little bit hard to read, but he compares the top bar in each of these is professed Christian youth, and the bottom bar is non-Christian youth. And the point of this is, even the ones that stick around, boy, that's annoying. You guys hear that? Wow, can't do anything about it. Even the ones that do stick around, they're really no different from their non-Christian friends. This top one here, we're satisfied with their ethics and character. Christians, 91%, non-Christians, 90%. Physically hurt someone with anger within the past 12 months, I think. 63% of Christian youth had, 67% of non-Christian youth had. Lied to a parent, identical. Lied to a teacher, almost identical. Cheated on a test, again, almost identical. We're talking like 1 or 2 percentage points difference. So, you know, even the kids that are sticking around, there's really no change in their lives. And you gotta imagine in those cases, it's just a matter of time before they leave as well. David Kinnaman, in his book Unchristian that came out 2 years ago, he's a researcher, and he did an extensive survey to gauge people's impressions of Christianity and also various trends. And he says that one of the primary words this group used to describe their impression of Christians is hypocrite. According to his research, 84% of young outsiders personally know a committed Christian, but just 15% thought the lifestyles of those Christ followers were significantly different from the norm. So he mainly focused on a group of about 24 million, what he calls outsiders, young outsiders. So this would be like people 18 to 29 who are not Christians. And so he's saying, you know, most of them know a Christian, and very few of them think that their lives are that much different. Okay, so we basically have completely adopted the world's values. We might have a few weird cultural things that we do as Christians, but by and large, it's the same. Tom Rainier, Essential Church, Reclaiming a Generation of Dropouts. You know, the books are just rolling off the presses about how young people in the millions are leaving the church. He says, perhaps most startling is the gravity of how many exit the church and the pace at which this exodus is occurring. Shock does not begin to describe how we felt after reading the research results. The church is losing the generational battle. Not only are we losing our nation to the ways of the world, but we are not winning our own children in Christian families. Multitudes are dropping out of the church. And you can just, you can sense the feeling of depression they felt, the shock, the horror as they sat down and looked at everything they had found, and they saw that we're losing this, it's a rout. Gene Twenge, non-Christian, wrote a book called Generation Me, where she studied the millennial generation, which is our current people that are in high school and college in their 20s. Here's what she has to say. Weekly attendance at religious services, high school seniors is only 26%. Even if you go down to the Bible Belt, we're talking less than a third of high school seniors go to church every week. And then if you extend that up into the 18 to 29-year-olds, that drops down to 18%. And this is particularly disturbing because, you know, this chart right here, which has been reproduced, you know, dozens of times over the last 100 years or so, this shows at what age did people come to Christ. And as you can see, the peak age for people coming to Christ is late high school and early college. You know, this is when people are leaving home, they're becoming adults, they're making adult decisions about their faith. And so this is the window when people are most likely, by far, to become Christians. And if somebody becomes a Christian in this age and they become a disciple of Christ, they're by far the most likely to devote their lives to following Jesus. And, you know, the scary part is if we're missing this window here, then it's not going to get any easier when they're in their 30s or 40s or 50s. That hasn't been our experience. If anything, by then, they're massively in debt, they're in a bad marriage, or they're in a failed marriage, they've devoted their lives already to pursuing selfish interests. It's pretty hard to turn around on that. So this is a real problem, and something's got to change here. Or otherwise, like McDowell argues in his book, The Last Christian Generation, this could really, truly be the last generation that's where there's any significant numbers of Christians as a part of it. And that's what we want to talk about. What do we do about this serious problem that is facing us today? Millennials and Xenos, you know, believe it or not, the Gen X is kind of a thing of the past. The very youngest Xers are turning 30 this year. Most people say that you know, Generation X ended right around 1980. And so anybody that was born in the 80s or early 90s is part of a different generation known as the Millennials. And you know, we'll talk about what we've both done some research on attitudes and trends within this millennial generation, and we're going to share some of those insights as well as some applications for ministry. And the reason we have credibility in this area, not that, you know, we've got it all together, we're perfect by any means, we've got lots of problems, but we have seen some success with reaching this millennial generation. You know, When I joined Xenos College Group, Xenos Student Ministry, the college high combined had less than 200 students, had about 6 home groups, roughly. That was in 1997. And this is really when the first wave of millennials was starting to hit college. Okay. Now in 2009, we've got more than 1,200 students. We've got 61 home groups. The majority of these home groups are led by students. We've got a few adults down here working with college and high school groups, but for the most part, these are really millennials leading these groups of millennials. And so God has really blessed our ministry pretty substantially, and we wanted to share a few of the things we've learned over this time period. But the main thesis that we're going to advance here this morning is this, that in order to win with this generation, we need to get millennials grounded in biblical truth, first of all. Contrary to what a lot of postmodern churches would say, that truth won't work, that people don't even have a category for this, they won't buy into this. Not true. We need to get them grounded in biblical truth while helping them get a vision for God's plan for their lives. We've got to have both of these things. So Conrad is going to come up and speak for a while about the pervasive cynicism toward truth and everything that we've got, and then I'll come up and talk a little bit more about the vision part.
Side. All right. Well, let's see. Well, you know, what I want to talk about are kind of the major barriers that I think are preventing us from reaching high school and college age students. Some of this stuff has been as a result of my personal learning, but also as a result of my observation working in student ministry now for, you know, many years, 10 years. But I want to kind of begin this whole section about major barriers in today's culture with this passage here, which I think is really the premier passage on how do we contextualize the gospel, meaning how do we use the or how do we take the gospel and bring it to the generation of people that we're living in today? Because culture changes, but the gospel never does. Paul, as he's speaking to these people, these Athenian people in the Areopagus, kind of the intellectual mecca of the ancient world, he says, I observe that you are very religious in all respects. For while I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, I also found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. Therefore, what you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and all the things in it, since he is the Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made of hands. So this is his introduction. Now, I think it's interesting because, first of all, what it tells us about Paul is that he immersed himself in their culture. He was kind of walking around, observing the culture, observing the city, observing the people, and he noticed this monument that was dedicated to this unknown God. Later in his talk, he actually refers to a well-respected ancient Greek poet in one of his talks. So he was using contemporary culture as kind of a launching pad for the gospel. The second thing that we notice, too, is that our understanding of culture really guides our approach. I think this is important because, you know, in a lot of ways, we have to understand and get in there with the culture that we're trying to reach. This has been a problem in the church throughout, where a lot of times young people feel like the church just doesn't relate to their lives at all. I know that growing up kind of in a more traditional church, I felt as though the church had nothing for me. I felt like what they had to say wasn't relevant to my life. But you know, when I started coming around to this college ministry, I remember how a lot of the Bible teachers that I first encountered, they were engaging with the culture. They understood the way that I thought. They understood the way that I lived my life, and they applied biblical truth in a way that I felt was so relevant. So part of this process, I think, kind of begins with us really immersing ourselves in the culture. Obviously, the gospel never changes. But the culture does change. And it's our job as people who have been commissioned by God to engage this culture with the gospel to understand who it is that we're talking to and what they're thinking about. But I think these two observations about this passage really inform one another. And the reason I say this is that not only do we need to immerse ourselves in the culture and understand it in order to bring the gospel. I think that one of the things I wanted to bring up in terms of this passage is that 10 years from now, the observations that I'm going to give you here that I have are going to be obsolete. We're not going to be talking about that anymore. Just like in the 60s, the climate, politically, culturally, all of that's different now. And we have to stay on top of the culture. And it's our job to really be in there with the culture that we're living with and understanding the way that they think. Otherwise, we're going to lose the people that we're trying to reach. So, with that kind of being the launching pad for the rest of what I have to say, I want to say that really I think what is going on here is that there's a pervasive cynicism that many young people today are struggling with that becomes a barrier for them coming to Christ. A recent study said that one of the ways in which young people get their news is actually through newspapers, online newspapers like The Onion and The Daily Show, which obviously are kind of spoofs of current, news feeds and everything else. So I wanted to show you guys some snapshots, maybe as kind of a way of showing that this cynicism is kind of widespread. What about this one from The Onion? It said, could leaning with your head against a wall cause depression? I mean, the idea is kind of like, you look depressed and that's kind of the way that you're acting. And, it's obviously kind of saying, well, it's probably just an act. You're not really depressed. What about this one? This one's about missions work and church work. It says, doing God's work, does it let God off the hook? What about this one? This was from the campaign before Obama got elected into the presidency. It says, as the 2008 presidential election draws closer, Democrat Barack Obama has reportedly been working tirelessly with his top political strategist to perfect his looking off into the future pose, which many believe is vital to the success of the Illinois senator's campaign. When performed correctly, the pose involves Obama standing upright with his back arched and his chest thrust out and his shoulders positioned about 1.3 feet apart and opened slightly at a 14-degree angle and his eyes transfixed on the predetermined point between 500 and 600 yards away. Advisors say this creates the illusion that Obama is looking forward to a bright future, while the downturned corners of his lips indicate that he acknowledges the problems of the present. So everything is kind of an act, you know? There's always something deeper there. There's a lack of sincerity. There's a lack of genuineness that people are piercing through and they're seeing. I think this pervasive cynicism really, I think, kind of goes throughout in every area of our lives and in our culture. You know, there's the cynicism of people. You have an experience where you have gotten close enough to a person where you have trusted them, only to find out that they backstab you or kick you in the teeth. You know, you think about, a person who you look at and you think, this person has a lot of moral fiber, but a thought crosses your mind, with enough money, anybody can be bought off. Or if you see a guy talking to a girl, and it may seem innocent, a thought may pass your head and say, well, he's just trying to get into her pants. These thoughts kind of, I think, govern the way that we look at the world and the people around us. When we go even a little bit deeper, psychological evolution suggests that we are really just a bundle of desires. And everything that we do really is impression management in order to get what we want. This is what Dick Keyes says in his book, Seeing Through Cynicism. He says, we are only bundles of desires and the mask worn to satisfy those desires. There's no unique essence of who I am that's durable over time. I'm the product of countless accidental factors in my culture and individual experience. I'm fluid. I don't struggle to find or discover myself. I choose to invent myself. This is no cause for despair, but for relief and exhilaration. It's exciting. I'm free to project what images I want into the world and make the world work the way I want. There's a fluid self, and we are free to recreate ourselves in order to get what we want. So, in a lot of ways, I think working with students, that is kind of the reason why it seems like image, self-image, is so important. Why you'll see that oftentimes teenagers today will go through these radical changes of clothing style. It's a recreation. And it's really a way to obtain what they want. Here's another quote from Kenneth Gergen from the Saturated Self, talking again about this generation. He says, on Saturday, he was talking about an experience where he was interviewing this woman. And he said, on Saturday, I went shopping with my teenage daughter. I needed a dress for a party the next week. And I saw a very attractive little dress, black, a daring cut, and with silver sequin. I was very excited until I tried it on. Dejectedly, I had to tell my daughter that I just couldn't take it. It wasn't me. And my daughter responded with gentle mockery. She said, "But Mom, that's not the point. With that dress, you could really be somebody." Gergen later points out that when you look at the two individuals in this story, the mother is more of a modernist. She feels like there's a secure sense of self, and that really her clothing is just an expression of that self. Whereas the daughter views clothing much differently. It's a way to recreate yourself. It's fluid. And really, I think that kind of matches our postmodern world, where there's this ever-changing way in which we act in order to get what we want. But really, I think one of the things is that when we focus on impression management, we obviously get what we want, but it's a prison house where we feel like we need to constantly recreate ourselves, but at the same time look to see beyond the surface and find what's really going on with other people. And so it's a prison house where we are constantly evaluating whether or not somebody else is doing exactly what we are trying to do. Then we have cynicism of institutions, government, family, and church. You think about government today, and you know, you look at Michael Moore's recent movie called Fahrenheit 9/11, and he was trying to connect George Bush and Osama bin Laden as the kind of co-conspirators of 9/11. And most people are buying into that in mass. I think it kind of strikes a note with us in our sensibilities that there's really something going on with the government that's just right below the surface that we're trying to find. Think about marriage. You know, what about marriage? I know that I was reading this one time, and this one divorce guy was quoted as saying, you know, "I got a new strategy. Instead of getting married again, I'm just going to find a woman I don't like and give her a house." And I think, you know, part of it is there is this cynicism towards the institution of marriage, partly because of the high rate of divorce that exists today. Many young youth today think, "I'm just never going to get married." In fact, they feel like getting married is a way that stifles their creativity and their capability to kind of recreate themselves. And so really, marriage is a hindrance to getting what they want. And finally, there's church. The cynicism towards the church has been something that has been around forever. Karl Marx coined kind of this popular phrase that most of us know, that religion is the opiate of the masses. And I think beyond Marx's speculation or his observation of the hypocrisy in the church, I think many of us don't need to be sociologists to see that there's a dissonance between the church's claims and what they do. There's a difference between their walk and their talk. And so as a result, there is this cynicism even of church that's driving people away. I guess I mentioned those things already. And finally, I think, and most importantly, there's a cynicism towards knowing the truth. You know, this was popularized many years ago by linguists such as Jacques Derrida and Michel Foucault. And these guys kind of were suspicious that language was being used as kind of a power play, that certain words were being used in a way to keep people down. And really, when you look at words, words are fluid in the way that we understand them. There's a lot of subjectivity to them. And so the collateral damage that that's done, really, I think, to the whole idea of whether or not we can obtain truth has been large. Where not only are people cynical of whether or not you can know things when you read it, but whether or not we can know truth in general. I remember I had an experience that kind of crystallized this for me when I was working in a high school group. We had a home group one night, and this new guy came out. And we sat down and we were talking, and we had a great conversation. He was very open to spiritual things, and he brought up some of the misconceptions he had about the Bible. Well, he didn't say they were misconceptions. I was pointing that out. We were discussing, and I was laying out some pretty good arguments, I thought, that were striking some blows with him. At times, he would nod his head in agreement and say, "Wow, that's really, you know, that's great." And so finally, I said, "Well, what do you think about all that I'm saying?" He said, "Well, you know, what you have to say is really interesting. But at the end of the day, I don't think you can really know the truth." So this entire time, I was having this conversation with him, thinking that we were tracking along together. But little did I know, he had kind of the trump card in his pocket the entire time. And it really rocked me. I drove home that night, and I was thinking about it. And I realized that entire conversation, we were never really on the same page. That the entire time, what I was saying to him meant nothing, because he never really believed that he could ever obtain truth. And so there's a cynicism towards truth in general. Whether or not you can know that God exists, whether or not you can really know that the Bible is true, whether you can really know that there is an actual truth. Well, I think the fallout of postmodernism is pragmatism. And what I mean by pragmatism is this idea that there's no way we can really know the truth, but instead we can live our lives kind of to the best of our abilities. Do things that get what we want and what we think is right. You know, today, even though I believe we're in kind of a postmodern culture, some of the language is still there, where you'll talk to even students today and you'll say, "Well, you know, do you think that there's any sort of like real truth outside of like what you believe?" And they're like, "Well, I don't know. I really believe that what's true for you is true for you." And I think it'd be easy to think that that is kind of like an extreme relativist statement, where they basically are saying, "Well, I can make up my own religion, or I can make up my own belief system, and that could be true on its own ground." But I don't think that's really what they're saying. I think that that's kind of an unfair caricature of what they're saying. I think what they're really saying is, when you look at the outcome of two people's lives who believe completely different things, some of the fruits are the same. You know, when you think about a Muslim and a Christian who both give to the poor and volunteer their lives, people look at that and say, "Well, I think that working with the poor and taking care of them is a really good thing. And look, here are these two different people who believe completely different things, and yet they're doing the very same thing." So instead of having to figure out this really big question of what is really true, you could just live your life in a way that ultimately kind of bears the fruit of these religions. And so really, pragmatism directs people's lives without having to consider truth. And this is totally true. I think the more and more I think about this idea of pragmatism, the more and more I feel like it fits with the generation we're trying to reach. God is kind of like a practicality. Whenever I need something, I can kind of call him in and get something I need. And so God is kind of more an instrument to get what we want rather than somebody that we should obey. And secondly, I think the consequences of pragmatism or the pragmatic view of truth are pretty overarching. First of all, what I've seen is that there's a dwindling interest in apologetics. You know, back when I first came to the college group, I remember we would hang out till like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, me and my friends, for several hours just talking about these new arguments that defended our Christian faith, and we were so excited about it. We would just talk about it nonstop. Yet, when I talk to people today, young people, and I say, well, you know, what do you think about like defending your faith or having good reasons for what you believe? They're kind of like, well, that really doesn't float my boat. I think what really kind of gets me there is the fact that I know God really changes my life. I've seen people's lives transform. I see a community of love. And that's really what convinces me. But then when they have to sit under teachers who have these atheistic agendas or these professors who have an axe to grind and want to cut the spiritual limbs underneath these young students, you find that over time, they start to wonder whether or not this whole Christianity thing was really true. They start to question. Maybe this is like some sort of like sociological stream that I've been swimming along. Maybe this isn't real. Maybe it's just because of the people I'm hanging out with that I'm acting this way. And they start to wonder whether or not they've fabricated the changes in their own life. And secondly, I think that the fallout of this is that they look to God to meet felt needs. I follow God because it makes me feel good. I follow God because it gives me a sense of assurance. Not because it's necessarily true, but because it does something for me. I think for me, that where this really kind of crystallized was when I was trying to mentor this one young guy, and I'd mentored him probably for 3 or 4 years. And during his senior year, you know, he was really struggling with depression. Some stuff had come up in his life that he had never talked about before, some abuse issues. And we had such a really difficult time working through that. And I remember talking to him about it extensively, and at one point he was at a breaking point, and he said, you know, I've read the Bible, I've prayed as much as I can, I've gone out there and served, but I don't feel any better. I think I'm going to quit. And I said, well, why do you think we follow God? And he sat there and tried to formulate an answer. And right before he was going to answer, I said, because it's true. Why do you think people who live in Muslim worlds or in Bangladesh become Christians, even though they know that there's a danger of them being killed for their faith? It's not because Christianity is going to produce a great outcome in their lives necessarily. It's because it's true. But he didn't buy that. He wanted to see immediate, tangible results. And so I think this pragmatic view of truth, the pragmatic view of Christianity, has made people's faith really fragile. Well, some of the application points I thought about in relation to this are pretty simple. First of all, I think we need to be transparent. As we're reaching students, I think we need to be open. You know, students are armed to the teeth with cynicism. And really, it's a veiled attempt of protecting themselves. Because they've been hurt before. They've opened themselves up to people who seem to be good people that they could trust, only to get hurt. And I think as people who are engaging these young people, opening up about problems that we have in our lives in a redemptive way and saying we don't have it all together, I think in a lot of ways melts some of those defenses that they have, those cynical defenses, and allows them to be able to engage with us. You know, even though a lot of students are looking for reasons to critique people and to find underlying motives that are really driving why they're doing what they're doing, I think at the same time, the real tragic irony is that they're looking for authenticity. They're looking for something real. They're looking for the capability to open up. Secondly, I think we need to be charitable to opposing views. I think we need to not only understand these people's views, well, but I think we need to be able to accurately kind of paint it. And I think really when, you know, you hear somebody express your view in a way that you probably would say in your own words, it suggests that you really, that person understands you. And I think once you strike kind of this note of understanding with a person, especially a student who's really cynical, I think it leaves them, it opens them up to say, well, maybe there is something that you could tell me. Maybe you really do understand where I'm coming from. Thirdly, I think we need to avoid gimmicky approaches to reaching students, okay? And this is real important. I know that in a lot of youth groups, what they'll do is they'll try to find, you know, these rock bands that are Christian influenced, that sound like contemporary musicians, but kind of don't. They'll go out and they'll try to get the best audio video system, or they'll spend tons of money to get all this decor to try to fit the contemporary culture. And I think all of that stuff kind of drives and maybe gives students a bigger target in terms of your church. I remember this one time in my high school, the large meeting that I teach, I know that as the staff members were like, you know, we want a way to kind of communicate broadly with the students in your large meeting that you teach. So I suggested, you know what, email I think is bad. You know, students kind of get an account, but they don't ever check that. So we need to figure out a more creative solution. So at the time, MySpace was really big. And so I was like, oh man, maybe we can make like a MySpace group or something, right? I was really proud of myself. I thought I was like pretty hip and I was like up on youth culture and stuff. And so I got this screenshot and I put it, pasted it into a PowerPoint. I showed it. You know, pretty proud of myself, and I was like, hey, so maybe we can join this MySpace group. And everybody's like, that is stupid. You know, you could hear audible, like, scoffs in the crowd. And as I expected, nobody joined, right? And part of it was they felt like you were trying too hard, you know? You're trying too hard to be hip, trying too hard to be cool. And again, it was just like, you know, it's just not real. It's not authentic. Ironically, you know, about a year later, when Facebook kind of became the big social networking site that everybody's on, a student from my large meeting decided to kind of, you know, without any kind of push or anything like that, to start up a group. And in mass, almost everybody joined that group. And I didn't even get an invitation. But it just goes to show, you know, when I do it, it's lame and gimmicky. But when a student does it, it's kind of cool. It's real. It's authentic, right? So the point is that as we try really hard to engage our culture on that level where we come up with these really, you know, contemporary things that we like to do, students are going to think that that's really lame. I just have to tell you that. I mean, it's the truth. I think what we have found to be most effective is teaching and preaching apologetics during our meetings. You know, you'd be surprised how interested students are when we say, tonight we're going to deal with a major problem that everybody thinks of, the problem of evil. If God exists, why is there so much suffering in the world? And most students are like interested in that. Or when I say, tonight we're going to present arguments for the existence of God, students are really into that. And that's really, I think, where most students really resonate in teachings that I give, is when I give an argument for the existence of God. Because it shows that you're confident in that, you know, I can come here and I can teach the truth and have real basis for my beliefs. It's interesting to them because they don't believe that you can have a basis for their belief besides what they feel. And really, this is a biblical thing. Think about what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, where he says, since then we know what it is to fear the Lord, and as a result, we try to persuade men. Persuading people through truth and reasoning. See that all throughout the Bible. 1 Peter 3:15 maybe is the premier passage on this. He says, sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks to give you an account for the hope that is in you. That word defense is the Greek word for apology. Apologetics. That's where we get the word from, this verse. So Peter's saying, you need to be able to give a defense for the faith. And I think if we arm students with the truth, they will be capable of sitting through a lecture at Ohio State or whatever universities around your town, or sit through a high school science class where the teacher's saying that God has no hand in the work of creation or in what we see, that they'll be able to say, well, I've got an opposing view to this, and I can sit and allow this to attack my view, but I know at the end of the day, I've got a pretty reasonable answer. And finally, I think personal investment is the only way to reach students effectively. It's not about just changing up our meetings. It's about going out into the culture. It's about spending time with students. I think one of the greatest things that we have seen in terms of being able to reach students effectively is when one of our leaders or one of our older workers gets in there with a younger believer who may be a new Christian or something like that and starts studying the Bible with them and teaching them apologetics and getting them grounded in God's truth. And they do this kind of on a weekly basis where they spend time relating, they spend time studying. And what will happen is students will just kind of spontaneously bring out other students. This is totally true in our high school groups where, you know, I know the freshman year of this one guy, this one guy's freshman year, what he did was, you know, he had a bunch of friends and he was excited about God. What he would do is he would get his parents to drive him throughout his block and he would stop in front of his friend's house and call him up on the spot and say, hey, dude, get your shoes on. You're coming to Bible study. And the kid's like, okay, I'll be out. It's an organic thing. So as we get students excited, you're going to see them bring people out. But it's through our personal investment and through grounding them in truth that's really going to give them the confidence to do that. So that's my part. Slim's going to kind of wrap up the rest of the presentation.
By wrap up, he means talk as long as he did. So now that I don't think you're getting out early. Okay, so we've talked about the all-pervasive cynicism. And the fallout, the wreckage, I guess you could say, that has left behind, we're going to call hyper-individualism. You know, if you can't trust anybody, if you can't trust any institution, if truth even is highly suspect, just a ploy that people use to gain power, then what this leads to is an even greater reliance on self. Now, it's not like, you know, back, you know, 100 years ago, people weren't like self-reliant or selfish. You know, I mean, since the fall, we've been wanting to be our own gods. And yet now there's certain sociological factors that are pushing us in that direction at an even greater rate. And so with this hyper-individualism, one interesting facet of the millennials, this generation, the oldest millennial is now, I guess they'd be in their late 20s, and the youngest millennials would be, you know, somewhere in high school, is they were brought up with this mantra pounded into their brains, you are special. This was not there before the millennial generation. Here's what Jean Twenge says. She says, the number of psychology and education journal articles devoted to self-esteem doubled between the 70s and the 80s, and then they increased another 52% during the 90s, and the number of books on self-esteem doubled over that same time. Another author, Millennial Makeover, says that over 9,000 books were written about self-esteem and children during the 80s and 90s. Fewer than 500 were written on the subject during the 70s. So a little different numbers being thrown out here, but the point is very little on it for the Xers. Vast amounts of literature were written on this for the millennials. By the mid-90s, the average Gen Z college man had higher self-esteem than 86% of college men in 1968. Okay, so they've been doing these self-esteem surveys for decades now, And Jean Twenge, she's working with like 1.4 million pieces of data for this book, Generation Me. And she says that you look at kind of the end of the boomers, and then you look at, well, really, maybe a little bit after the boomers, but, and then you look at by the mid-90s, and that the average self-esteem had shifted up to the 86th percentile mark, okay? So people just have so much self-esteem now, and women was not quite as much, but still pretty high. A survey of 1997 survey of teens asked, in general, how do you feel about yourself? These are teenagers, okay? So this is like the most dramatic, emotional time in your life. A stunning 93% answered good. Of the remainder, 6% said that they felt not very good, and only 1% admitted that they felt bad about themselves. Another survey found that 91% of teens describe themselves as responsible. 74% as physically attractive, and 79% as very intelligent. Very intelligent. One children's book, first published in 1991, is called The Lovables in the Kingdom of Self-Esteem. So this is like an entire land called the Land of Self-Esteem. Here's how the book starts. I am lovable. Hi, lovable friend. My name is Mona Monkey. I live in the kingdom of self-esteem along with my friends, the lovable team, the book begins. On the next page, children learn that the gates of the kingdom will swing open if you say these words three times with pride. I'm lovable, I'm lovable, I'm lovable. Man, if there's anything that expresses human autonomy from God better than this, you know, it'd be hard to find. You know, you're just chanting how lovable you are. If you chant three times, then you're going to have self-esteem. What a fake, unfounded basis for self-esteem that these kids are being raised on. Here's another one. This is the Be a Winner, Self-Esteem Coloring and Activity book. As you can see, everyone here is first place in the Be a Winner book, but everyone's first place in a different way. You see, he's first place. He's on the honor roll. She's number one music. Even the cat has high self-esteem in this coloring book. I guess the dog is the only one that has low self-esteem in this entire picture. Doesn't have a ribbon. You are special. Twenge goes on to say that many school districts across the country have specific programs designed to increase children's self-esteem, most of which actually build self-importance and narcissism. Self-love is what it actually builds. One program is called Self-Science. The subject is me. Why bother with biology? I'm so much more interesting. She says, boomer children in the 50s and 60s gained self-esteem naturally from a stable, child-friendly society. Gen Me's self-esteem has been actively cultivated for its own sake. You know, it's like there's this factory that's synthetically producing self-esteem and injecting it into kids. Because they're not gaining it through a healthy, stable family. They're gaining it, you know, in the midst of, you know, a family and a culture that's falling apart, that's dangerous. It's being pumped into them through these, you know, really superficial ways of gaining self-esteem. And so let's stop for a moment and apply this material then. How does this apply to working with millennial youths? Well, for one, we got to critique and resist the world's approach to self-esteem. We got to point out that, you know, the reason that you're special is not because of how you perform. It's not because you tap your heels together and you chant, I'm lovable, three times. It's not because you've just tried to convince yourself and everybody's always told you that. You know, it kind of like the altar to the unknown God. They know there's something there. They know that there's something significant about me, and yet their approach to understanding that significance is completely off base. And what they've done is they've exchanged the image of the incorruptible God for an image formed incorruptible man. And they've turned and they've worshipped the created thing rather than the creator. They're creating their own identity. They're creating a name for themselves. You know, just like the Tower of Babel. And so we've got to point out that that is not an adequate basis for why you're worth something. And instead, we need to replace that by teaching God's perspective on identity and significance. The reason you're important is because of what God says about you. You know, whenever I start studying the Bible with somebody, you know, I'll meet with people one-on-one to mentor. We call it discipleship here. First thing I do is I go through identity truths. I go through Ephesians chapter 1, for example, and I'm like, all right, what does this say about you in Christ? And we start exploring this, and you should see the look on people's faces as for the first time they see that I am God's inheritance. I am adopted as God's child. I am sealed. I have an inheritance that is never going to go anywhere. You know, there's still several guys that I've studied that they can still tell you exactly where we were when we studied that, what they were feeling, and they'll still talk about it. Some people a decade later. You know, and also to teach identity, to teach that the basis for spiritual growth is not zoning out or some weird New Age mysticism thing, but it's understanding your identity, living based on your identity. You know, we've got to pound this home with people and show them that what you were taught, you know, the intention was good, but the way they went about it was completely bankrupt. So we need to teach, what does God say about this? And that's going to resonate with people of all ages, but I think especially people in this millennial generation. Okay, so the idea that you are special, there's a few things that flow out of that as well. Another one is this idea here, you don't need anyone's approval. If you are special no matter what, you know, if everybody gets a ribbon, if everybody gets a badge, if everybody gets an award, you know, you don't need anyone else's approval. Don't let anybody else tell you that you can't do it. You've got to look deep within and find the goodness that's there, and then that is what, that's what makes you significant. And so what other people have to say, well, here, I'll read this quote from, this is again from Generation Me. This is, she's talking about a friend of hers who was a journalist who began teaching classes at a community college. Here's what the guy says. He says, students seemed uncomfortable with the idea that he knew more than they did. And even with the idea that my knowledge and skills were important or even relevant. Student after student balked when he corrected their essays, several complaining that his comments were just your opinion. One teacher always announced, I have some expertise, you have some expertise, my job is to facilitate this process, and please, call me Beth. The message, we're all equals here. I might have a PhD and years of experience, but that doesn't mean I know any more than you, 18-year-old going to community college. They said that one day he said that he decided to give the exams back and then go over the exams with them in class. And he said people were objecting all over the place, not because there was a grading error, but just because they just didn't agree with the things that he had marked wrong. And so there's this cynicism and skepticism works its way over into nobody's going to tell me what to do. Classrooms are increasingly structured for teachers to be facilitators rather than authority figures. Lecturing is frowned upon, collaborative learning is in. It's more of a coffee shop environment. More of a Twitter environment where everybody's saying this, that, and the other thing. It's, you know, the internet gains its authority through a bunch of different voices speaking. And that's kind of the way that the classrooms are moving more and more toward this arrangement. Yet, so the weird thing is, there's this, on the one hand, there's this notion that you don't need anyone's approval. And yet, at the same time, there's this really strong bond with parents. Here's a quote from a Wall Street Journal article from a few years ago. This guy says, who works at the University of Georgia, he says that students who get frustrated or confused during registration have been known to interrupt their advisors to whip out a cell phone, speed dial their parents, and hand the phone to the advisor saying, here, talk to my mom. Says Richard Mellendore, a University of Georgia professor and former vice president of student affairs. The cell phone, he says, has become the world's longest umbilical cord. And I don't know if you've heard this term, helicopter parents. Anybody heard this? It's the notion that parents are just kind of hovering around their kids like a chopper, you know, watching out for them, protecting them, calling, complaining to professors, complaining to teachers, getting jobs for them, calling, you know, their kid will go to get a job when he graduates from college and the parent will call to negotiate the salary. It's this weird, like, on the one hand, you're special, you don't need anybody's approval, but there's this kind of sheltered nature. You know, a lot of millennials will say their parents are their best friends. And so parents actually can, in many cases, certainly more than with Xers, have quite a bit of influence in their kids' lives. I don't know if this is a backlash from the boomers' parents being totally emotionally absent or what, or if there's some weird codependency thing going on, obviously, but it's like they're so protective. These are the kids that grew up with all this modern safety regulations, the car seats, the antibacterial soap, you know, it's they've just been protected for so long, and it's having a negative effect on some of them because, you know, they have a hard time making decisions, making adult-type decisions, and, you know, they could be easily crushed. That self-esteem can be easily crushed when they come face-to-face with the real world. And here's another corollary to that is you can be anything you want, just work hard and put your mind to it. You can be anything you want. Material affluence is very important to millennials. You know, these kids grew up as credit cards were becoming widely available, easy credit, and then in a few more recent years, the home equity boom, where there's all this money all of a sudden that parents have. In 1967, less than half of college freshmen said it was important to be well off financially. In 2004, this climbed up to 74%. Okay, so that's more than 50% increase in this. That it's important to be well off financially. Check this out. College kids spend $2.6 billion a year decorating their spaces, about $1,200 each. They're actually bringing in these dorm design consultants to design their kids' space. Because they've got to be special, they've got to be different, they've got to have, you know, the newest, latest stuff. You know, a lot of these kids grew up watching, you know, I guess kind of the initial version of this was Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, but now you've got all these shows on MTV and various channels like Pimp My Ride, Cribs, Extreme Home Makeover. And so, you know, you spend a half hour watching a show on Shaquille O'Neal's house, and it's like, man, I should have a house like that. I'm special, I deserve that. And I don't know, what are they spending $1,200 a year on to decorate their dorm rooms? The average high school couple spends $800 a year on their prom night, up from $300 5 years ago. You got the limo, you got the hotel, you got the dinner, you got the expensive dress, the tuxedo, the flowers, astronomical on a single night. And part of what this produces, too, is there's high levels of anxiety and pressure on yourself. Getting a college degree is more and more important. Getting scholarships, as the cost of housing and education has risen astronomically, there's a tremendous amount of pressure on self. And I think the parents are putting a lot of pressure on their kids to do this. Here's weekly hours of children aged 3 to 12 by activity. This is the percent change from 81 to 97. Okay, so this is over the millennial era. This is how it's changed. Time spent outdoors has dropped by 50%. Time spent just free play, where they just, you know, there's nothing actually scheduled, it's just like, go and play. That's dropped by a quarter. Surprisingly, TV has dropped 13%. Time eating has dropped 11%, so they're eating faster. They're watching a little less TV. I think partly because school is up 38%. Not to be confused with studying, which is up almost 60%. Okay, so that's time just at and in school, up by 40%. Which, if they were already there 5 days a week 30 years ago, I don't know what that means. It must be they're spending longer at school, the year must be longer. I'm really not sure what that means. But school and studying are up 40 and 60% respectively. Organized sports, 86%. Which this matches up, where you'll see the average kid is in sports 3 seasons, 4 seasons a year, and in some cases, 2 sports or 2 activities per season. Household work is up 140%. and visiting slash traveling is up 169%. So our kids are being whipped into this frenzy of activity. There's all these secular books coming out about this. The Christian world has been strangely silent on this issue. And we'll even see this a lot of times where a kid will be doing well spiritually and then all of a sudden they don't have time for anything else because they're taking the honors program at school, they're in the traveling soccer league. It's pretty weird that, you know, for the kids and for the parents, these other things go in first, and then God gets the time that's left over. Twenge says, in this world where essentials like housing are so astronomically expensive, what messages has Gen Me been fed? Save your money? Feel lucky to have a house, even if it's not a mansion? Of course not. In the world of individualism and consumer longing, we've been taught to expect even more. She gives a quote from Tyler Durden, Fight Club, kind of a classic youth rebellion movie, where the guy was going through all the motions, accomplishing the material things, and then just completely snapped and went the other direction. He says, our generation has had no great depression, no great war. Our depression is our lives. We were raised on television to believe that we'd all be millionaires, movie gods, rock stars, but we won't. And we're starting to figure that out, and we're very, very pissed off. Which is ironic coming from Brad Pitt. If there ever was a movie god, that would be him. But the point is that there's kind of this, in some cases, a recoil, where they were taught to expect all these things. Their self-esteem, you know, was inflated. Really, which was their ego, was inflated to a pretty large level. And then they just couldn't cope with the real world, and so they snapped and they've kind of crumpled back in. Some are moving back home. In the past, people got married, got a job, had kids, but now there's a new 10 years that people are using to try and find out what kind of life they want to lead. You know, I've got to follow my heart, and until I'm like a video game tester for a living, I just can't cope with reality. It's weird, the people coming out of college now, what they're expecting for a job. This long, you know, 15-bullet-pointed list of all the things that I need to have. There's a lot of literature actually coming out for companies to deal with millennials hitting the workplace because they're so different than the Xers before them. And the thought of, I just need to work a crappy job for a while and not make that much money, that is so foreign to a millennial. That, you know, not my precious, you know, not me. That's not for me. And this really, this lines up so closely, so well with our experiences. You know, they're different from Xers. When I first entered the college group 12 years ago, we were working with Xers. And, you know, it was like we were just pushing as hard as we can for them to not lay around all day. They were pretty content to just drop out of school and work at a coffee shop 20 hours a week. No ambition, just kind of this grunge, whatever kind of culture. And nowadays, it's like, you know, the past 4 or 5 years, it feels like everybody in my home church is in grad school. People, you know, they're spending so much time on schoolwork and work. You know, it's like, if now we're pushing the other thing. We're like, wow, you know, why don't you spend a little bit of time with people and pursuing the things of God? And why don't you put this first in your life and not all those other things? It's a complete reversal from just 10 years ago. What the colleges are saying, there's one kid I know who started at Ohio State last year, and he went to the orientation for the engineers. And the speaker came out, and the first thing that the speaker said was, if you have a girlfriend or boyfriend, you should just go ahead and break up with them now. Everybody started laughing. She's like, I'm serious. Those things don't usually work out anyway. If you want to succeed, you need to do this and only this for the next 4 or 5 years of your life. What the college counselors are saying, a friend of mine took a job working with someone about a year ago who was a counselor at Ohio State for several years. He just graduated with his master's in social work, and he started working at this with this woman who had worked for Ohio State, and she said, more than 90% of the cases that we would see were anxiety and stress due to pressure to achieve in school. Kids would come in and they would say, I got a B on my test. I'm not going to listen to my iPod for 2 months. Partly to punish themselves, partly because I just need to buckle down and focus on studying. They would say, I got a B in organic chemistry. I might as well drop out of school. Crazy. But it's just, there's so much pressure. You can feel the weight of years of pressure, self-imposed and imposed by parents and society. And kids are losing it. What's interesting, too, is the same woman was saying that she went through the marriage the counseling program at a local university, not Ohio State, a different one in town. And she said that her advisor early on advised her to just go ahead and take a break from the serious relationship that she was in. He said most marriages fail by the time people make it through this program because it's so demanding. So you really should just go ahead and break things off now. And these are the people counseling our marriages. Can't even make it through the marriage counseling program without their marriage dying. It's this frenzy of performance, and it's all motivated by money. And these are what kids are operating under. This is what you have to perform and achieve. How do we apply this? Good question. Again, just like before, we need to critique and resist what the world says about living a significant life. We have to critique this. What is your life going to count for? What is going to matter when you get to the end of your life? Is it going to be your GPA in high school? No. It doesn't even matter once you get to college. Is it going to be your grades in college? No. Nobody cares in the workforce about your grades in college. Is it going to be the fact that your traveling soccer team was runner-up in the state championship? No, nobody cares about that either. The soccer skills really are not that important for life success. I love this parable that Jesus tells about this guy who, just spent his life trying to accumulate and hoard things for himself. And he says, after he had just constructed this lavish building project to have even more places to hoard his stuff, God visits him and he says, you fool! You will die this very night. And then who will get everything you worked for? This is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich toward God. The person who is not rich toward God, who does not just lavish time, money, emotions, resources into his relationship with God, into serving God, he says that they're a fool. And somebody else is going to get everything they worked for. I couldn't have agreed more with what Ajit said at the end, where he said, the person is not a fool who gives up what he can't keep and reaches to attain something that he can't lose. We've got to instill these values in our kids. We've got to preach this. We've got to live this way. We've got to call them to account on this. And if not, then we're going to lose everything. And we need to replace what the world says about significance by teaching what God says about how to live a significant life. We need to argue that, devoting your life to the things of God, devoting your life to building a ministry, regardless of what career God calls you into. First of all, you should really pick a career that allows you to be heavily involved with other people, that allows you to significant involvement, pouring your life into other people, fulfilling the Great Commission. There's certain things where, there's certain careers where if you're like a genius, you can do it. But, the average person who is real bad at math and is trying to go into engineering, it's just this complete disconnect from reality that's driven by the financial and achievement pressures. And that just doesn't even fit them. And, I think we do a good job with this here. For our high school students here, we really try and encourage them. Instead of going away for college, why don't you pick a school in town and join in with the work that we're doing here? And, we get, 85, 90% of our high school kids, they end up sticking around and joining our college ministry. And even the kids that are in college, we urge them to pick a career that allows you to serve God, a major that allows you to be real involved with the things of God. And then even when people graduate, almost, you know, most of them, at least the ones that are doing ministry, they stick around. They stick around because they've got disciples, people they've been pouring into for a couple of years now. You know, they've led a few friends to Christ, and they've led a few friends to Christ. And now all of a sudden, there's this whole house church that is directly related to them and their relationships, and it's really cool. You know, we've got students, we've got a facility down on campus. You can go there any day of the week and see 20, 30 college students meeting with one another to study the Bible for discipleship. We've got, we do a class that's kind of a, we kind of try and bill it as a cross between seminary and like Fight Club, where it's, you know, it's 3 hours a week with some, several hours a week of homework, and it's six quarters. So, you know, we're talking 60 weeks, 3 hours a week class that our students are chomping at the bit to get into this class, to get equipped to minister. And so if you can paint a vision for students to pour their lives into other people, they will eat this up. I remember when I was a senior in high school, I went to a church back in Cincinnati where I grew up, and I just remember thinking, the leader was going to be gone 1 week, and I remember thinking, man, that would be so cool if he asked me to teach this meeting. And, you know, I don't know if I could do it, but boy, if he asked me and I got some help, that would be awesome. And he never did. It never even, you know, came up. Whereas, you know, we're constantly putting this vision out before people that it's you're the one that's got to do the work of the church. You know, the job of the leaders is to equip the members to do the work, as Paul argues in Ephesians 4:11-12. And so if we can actually believe that our students can do something significant besides just sit around and be entertained, that's exciting. It's paradoxical that calling on them for more will result in more commitment. You'd think the more you called for, the less people would be into it. But they want to do something great. And we got to say, how about you do something really great? Something eternal with your life. So we need to give them opportunities to minister and enough equipping to do a good job. Like I said, the vast majority of our high school and college groups are led by our college students. And they do great work. A lot of times it's better than we can do because they're insiders. They're you know, it's one of their own. They're this is cross-cultural work. It's like missionaries that train the local natives to go and work with the natives. That's what we're doing here. And that's why our personal investment in them is so important, and urging them to personally invest in other people is so important. And You may need to get the parents on board with this, especially given the incredible influence that parents can have in their kids' lives. You know, instead of the parents, you know, monitoring their kids' grades and calling the school and complaining about that, you know, the parents would be saying, hey, how's your spiritual life going? How's your ministry going? Getting excited about when kids do great things for God. You know, instead of bringing the kids up in front of the church when they graduate high school or when they get accepted to Harvard, how about we bring them up in front of the church to teach the Bible for 40 minutes? How about we bring them in front of the church to tell everybody that, you know, this person is planting their house church because they've been faithful to God and God has grown their ministry. And I think what we honor and recognize, who we put up front, really says a lot about what we think is important. So, in summary, the things we've talked about here, really three things, right? We talked about this overarching statement, we need to get them grounded in truth while helping them get a vision for God's plan for their lives. And so we talked about their cynicism towards truth. We need to give them God's perspective on truth. We talked about their skewed self-esteem, false foundation for identity. We need to give them God's perspective on identity, why they value. I mean, that's the kind of thing, you know, that's the kind of thing that makes them want to just sell everything and buy the field, to buy the pearl of great price, is when they experience the grace and mercy of God. And finally, we need to help them see God's perspective on achievement, that it's not what the world says. It's not working, it's not devoting your whole life to something you can't keep anyway, but it's devoting your whole life to something that is eternal. Something where 10,000 years from now, you're not going to be sitting around saying, boy, I wish I'd gotten a better grade in that chemistry class. You're going to be saying, boy, you know, I'm so glad that I poured my life into other people and that these people are here with me today because of what God did through me. And then practically, the way we do this is investment. We've got to invest time. And leadership. We're going to have to put good leaders here. You know, if you've got a youth ministry that's faltering, a lot of churches, the youth minister is the guy right out of seminary that they can hire for a quarter what the senior pastor makes, who doesn't have any experience and is looking to get something on his resume so he can get a real pastor job. We need to have people that are burdened for the youth, you know, the future. at our church, the head guy, the guy who makes as much or more than anybody, he does college work. And at one point, a lot of our elders, they turned and they said, you know, youth ministry, we're facing a crisis. We need to get something going here. And so they all, almost everybody, every good worker in our church, we had down doing youth work. So we need to invest time, money, and maybe a good leader, even, into this ministry. We need to get into their lives. We need to understand their culture. You can't just be like, well, Facebook, that's just one of these newfangled things. Kids these days. You know, if you ever find yourself saying kids these days, you're in bad shape. You got to get a text plan. You got to get on Facebook. Don't actually initiate with anyone on Facebook. Just get on there and let them try and be your friend, okay? You get into their lives, and that's understanding them, but also building relationships. That's how you're going to earn their trust and pierce through the cynicism. They actually really do want to trust people. And they can become, your best, most loyal friends in a pretty short period of time. I'm continually amazed, as I get older and farther separated from the students in my group, to say, my best friends, some of them are 18, 19, 20 years old. You treat them like adults, they'll become adults pretty quick. And they'll do amazing things for God. And finally, you've got to train them to take over. They need to constantly see, this is your ministry, you're the one that's really going to do the good work here. And you're constantly talking about, when you're praying with them, you're praying, God, I pray that this my person will win a disciple. My person will be able to lead their friend to Christ. They put me up in front of a meeting with 300 people when I was 21 years old to teach the Bible. I mean, that says a lot to everybody, including me, about this is the direction we're heading. So you got to constantly be trying to hand things over to the next generation. So that's what we had. What time is it? It slits out at noon. We got about 15 minutes. It says noon, right? Am I right? Good. So we've got a little bit of time for questions and or answers. So yeah, we got back there. Yeah. We do offer classes for high school students periodically, but it's mainly college students. We're a little reluctant to put like brand new freshmen in there unless somebody's like really serious and really can handle it. But we've even put people, partway through their freshman year into this course and. They're doing pretty well, we'll do classes for high schoolers periodically, but we haven't put any high schoolers into this class yet.
Yeah, I think one of the things that at least my philosophy and I may differ in some ways with other people here who are on staff in high school, but I know that what I do is I try to teach on a level where I'm trying to provide some meat and some content. And it's challenging for freshmen coming in, but I think that it's also exciting for them because a lot of times coming, from middle school, the teachings are basic. And, by the time you get to eighth grade, it's kind of like, well, the audience or the crowd that the teachers are aiming towards are the younger people. But when they get into high school, a lot of times they're amazed just at how much information is being taught there. And typically, if I keep the level high, it keeps even juniors and seniors who've kind of sat through years of Bible teaching, it keeps them pretty excited and challenged. So I think keeping the bar high, and I know that when we do classes or when I teach high school classes, I kind of go all out, and the students feel challenged by it and like it. So I think Having equipping classes for high school is pretty good too, but keeping the bar semi-high.
And I'm sure there's like one in every city, but like of the countercultural, like anarchist, like rebellion kind of like, you know, we play punk shows in our houses and, you know, we can do this together kind of mentality. It was like, it was really cool. And I had these two communities, there was this certain aspect of community being important. But I remember getting into a conversation with a good friend of mine from the anarchist community. He said, "Oh man, you're going out to Xenon? That's a cuss word, man, in like the punk community. Because it's like, these guys are like doing all these things and trying to like proclaim that there's only one, you know, all this stuff about like only one reality and one truth, you know, and like that's really offensive." And I don't know if it was, I mean, I'm usually a wuss, but I don't know if it was like the spirit, but I was just like, I love you, man, but I'm not gonna sit here and like listen to you like say this when I believe that. Like I believe that there's truth. And a while later, my band got the opportunity to go on tour with his, and it was like 10 days, and like we got in a few spiritual discussions, but none really that intense. And later I was like reading his blog, which is like blogs carry a big significance to that community, and he said, you know, something about St. Seneca, the band, and like it's like these kids have, a few of these kids have like this idea of like God and all this stuff, but it's real, it's authentic, and it's genuine.
Mm.
And that was like, I broke down. I was like, what? You know, like this is the guy who told me that he specifically didn't like that.
Yeah.
And yet he obviously was searching for that. That's a cool picture of that.
Mm. Like, that's awesome. Yeah.
What I try to do is, you know, I've mentored a few students coming out of, you know, grown up in Xenos and stuff, and, you know, so they know a lot of stuff. They've sat under tons of Bible teaching, and, you know, especially if their parents are pretty spiritually minded, they're, you know, having talks with their parents about their spiritual lives. But I think one of the lingering problems is that they think that because they can speak the language, they know the language. So a lot of times what they understand are biblical concepts, but not really the Bible. And so what I try to do is I try to say, look, you know, you need to, you know, sometimes I'll challenge them in our first few meetings and say, so, you know, you talk about your identity in Christ. Where would you turn in the Bible to, you know, point this out to somebody? And they'd be like, I don't know. And I just kind of go down the line and, you know, not to make them feel ignorant, but just to show, like, you know, you don't really know as much as you do. And I think that kind of creates a hunger for them to say, well, I do want to know now where this is in the Bible. And so I think challenging them to understand that these concepts that they've kind of grown up understanding, like grace and forgiveness, that this stuff is from the Bible, and trying to make that connection. So I think that's one thing. And the other, I think, is just trying to launch them off and to serve. I think when you serve and you're put in situations that are difficult and challenging, like God is going to orchestrate it that you feel pretty inadequate. And I think that that's another way to kind of maybe get the spiritual hunger going there. So that's my experience, though.
Yeah, and what I've done, too, along with that is just to get people deeper into the Word, because they do have like a soundbite knowledge of Scripture. But to study in depth through a whole book of the Bible, for example, A lot of people, it's just like they, for the first time, they really see the wonder and awe of deep study and seeing God speak to me from the page, and can really challenge them. Help this. You kind of just got to help them see that you got to make this your own. What you've been doing up until now, I'm glad you did it, but are you going to go deeper? Or have you arrived now that you're 18 years old? Good. Yeah. Yeah.
And that transformed.
Mm-hmm.
It's like simple as just taking them to Toronto and working with the downtown homeless.
Yeah.
And my daughter's going this weekend for another one. They take these kids, they bag lunches, they go sit with the homeless and talk to them and share Christ with them. These kids came back totally changed. Oh my gosh, there's another world out there. Mm-hmm. Not my sweet little, you know, world where I have everything provided. These kids, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, it transforms them when they see that their little world is nothing compared to what's out there. There are suffering people out there that they can minister to. And plus, coupled with the teaching,
yeah.
To have the biblical foundation,
yeah.
To say why it works for them and how God can help them, it transforms them. Really does.
Yeah, just a retreat, just getting students away and in community for 36 hours for a weekend. It's great, but if you can couple it then with service or exposing them to the poor, a different part of the world that is not your comfortable world, then they start to feel a tension between that and their lives, and they just want to do something about it. It's a great point. Yeah.
Great. Yep. We tell them slow down.
I don't know. I mean,
it's a big challenge for us.
Yeah. I don't think there's a silver bullet kind of answer that's gonna cure that, but I think part of it is preaching. You know, when we get up there, we critique that culture. We critique that, you know, not having any quiet time for God and kind of leaving Him. You know, there's a bottom line, which is my schedule, and God kind of gets whatever's left over. That's unacceptable. And I think, you know, part of it is we talk about that, but I think also we try to get to some of the deeper root issues, which is the love of the world system. That, you know, if you love the world system, you know, and trying to get material goods and trying to get success so that you can be sweet and kind of build your ego around that, that it's a bankrupt system, and that ultimately God is the one who you should derive all that from. And so I think a combination of personal correction, but also preaching, I think, is part of what we do. I don't know if you have anything to say to that.
Yeah, I would say you got to have a positive vision and a negative vision. If you pursue the world, I mean, that's what Ajith did there this morning, right? He's like, it's, you know, you're not a fool if you give up something you can't keep to gain something you can't lose. And so to paint the negative vision of here's the American dream, and then to paint the positive vision of serving God is real exciting. Because you can't just preach against it. You really got to preach more toward what you're holding out. And you got to inspire people to want to pursue that. You know, we're teaching through Acts right now. We got to Acts 2:42 where it talks about the early Christian community. And did some preaching on this. You can, if you go to the website under Acts 2, under Dennis's, I think they probably got his uploaded by now. But if you look at his second teaching in Acts 2, you'll see some example of some of the preaching we'll do on this. But you really just got to give them something good to fill their lives with and call them to it and model it, and hopefully they'll listen. Yeah, so we probably should wrap up here. Thanks for coming, everybody. You're dismissed.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.